Hello, this is Pearl Lam Podcast, and today I'm in Miami. I have two really good friends joining me, and I've known them for nearly 20 years. Yes, and I think at this point I would just have Mario and Robert, Robert and Mario, just give a brief about yourself to the audience.
So my name is Mario Cater-Fretch. I was born in El Salvador, Central America. Came to the U.S. to go to school. In the middle of my studying, I met Robert 35 years ago. And that's how I stayed. Or that's why I stayed. Not how I stayed. That's why I stayed. Originally, I studied international affairs. And I had a very short stint as a diplomat. And quickly...
As a diplomat? Yes. I didn't even know.
So I went to Georgetown University and... with a degree in international affairs. At the time, I thought I wanted to be a diplomat, and I was for 5 years. And then I realized, it's not really what I thought I wanted to do. And I also studied marketing and communications before that. And eventually, luckily, I got a job with MTV.
Yeah,
and in Viacom. I worked there for a very long time. And that's kind of what I've done. The most part of my life. Separately from that, I have a passion for studying different things. And my last 10 years I've dedicated to studying religion and to understand the intersections of religion and media, and more specifically honing on Hollywood films and how screenwriters use religion knowingly or not, intentionally or not, implicit or explicit. And what does that mean? And that's what I'm trying to decode now.
Oh, great. Robert?
My name is Robert Wennett, and I studied finance and real estate, first at the University of Pennsylvania and then at Columbia University, where I did my master's degree. I've been working in retail real estate and mixed-use projects for the last 35 years, first by developing lifestyle shopping centers and then transforming that into buying properties in downtowns around the United States and creating sort of senses of place, mixed-use projects where people can walk, dine, entertain, and socialize.
I met Robert, that was during the time he was building 111 Lincoln's Road. I think 111 Lincoln's Road is really interesting. It is a car park turned to be a shopping center, and the both of you are still living on top of 111 Lincoln Road. But what makes you, what gives you that tick that you want to have a garage and then have a shopping? We consider you as a visionary. I think many real estate world consider you as a visionary of building something different.
So I think that, I recognize it was one of the most important sites in Miami Beach. It was the entrance to Lincoln Road back in the 1920s. It had deteriorated over the years, and they had built a brutalist building there in the 1960s, which basically was just cut off all traffic and iteration with the public. So my idea there was, how do I fold this property back into the public space of Lincoln Road? And so the site kind of dictated the use. We really didn't have that much ability to build so much office or retail or residential. We really only had the right, given the zoning requirements, to build mostly parking. So I didn't really want to build a parking garage, because a parking garage is basically, like a warehouse for cars.
Yeah.
And it's not a very public program. It's not one that the public engages with. So I decided to build something, to hire a world-class architect and to come up with a scheme to build a parking garage, which was basically open to the public and would serve more like a black box where lots of activities could take place. And that's kind of the iteration of 1111 Lincoln Road, which was retail, parking, and restaurants.
But even your garages, I mean, there are companies renting it for events. You never heard of any companies renting garage for event. And yours is really is a pioneer. You've done really something really special.
Well, I think the idea was that the garage itself, at certain times, you would park cars in it. And at other times, you would do all kinds of other uses. So today people do fitness in the gym every single day. We do yoga. We have events. Almost every major brand has used the garage for their brand, not only in fashion and music and in cars, in clothing. Because the building itself, you know, when you look at the building, doesn't look like a garage. It's basically a sculpture, and it's because of the ceiling heights, the very high ceiling heights, and the openness, it really functions as a public space. So you have to think about lifting the public space from the ground floor all the way up to the seventh floor. And that's what I think is the success of that building, which is that the public really engages with the building at all times. You know, I've read many, many stories about this, but I think 1111 is one of the most liked buildings in Miami, and it's one of the most photographed buildings in Miami. So the public has responded really well to this being part of their community.
It is a landmark.
Not only a landmark, but it actually functions as something that people want to use. So if you think about if we had built a parking garage there, there would be a very ubiquitous program that would just serve as, you know, parking garage and be closed to the public. And this is very open. People bring their friends to the garage. Yeah. They go up to the seventh floor. They go to events. They marvel at the fact that there's a penthouse on the top. So, you know, it just feels like something that is just so much part of everyday life. And, you know, I think the success of a project is how it's received by the public. And you don't really know that when you start to build something. And when you say you're going to build a parking garage, you would think nobody would have any interest. And how did this project become such a landmark for Miami? It's not because it's a parking garage. It's because it's a space that people can engage with and they feel comfortable with, and they love the architecture. And it relates to the environment. It's got a lot of concrete in it, which has a lot of history in Miami in the 1950s and the 1960s. So there's just so many things that people really want to utilize in this building. And I think that's a success.
I have to thank for you to build 111 Lincoln's Row because you were lending me all the painters and all the builders to help me to do the art fair. I am forever indebted to 111 Lincoln's Road. I think one of the very interesting things you were telling me when you were building that building is the concrete. Because that was a concrete building, and you were telling me that you were going around trying to get people to do the concrete blocks in a quality that you want. I think it's very interesting for the audience to know how involved you are as a developer going to look at the quality of the buildings, the quality of the construction.
Well, I think in that project, we actually didn't want architectural concrete. So, because architectural concrete is of another level, and in some ways it was really too precious for a parking garage. So I think the beauty of the concrete is it's quite bold, but it's not trying to be a finished museum. It just took a lot of time and a lot of patience.
But you are personally being, you know, you don't ask anyone to supervise or to look at the final finishes. You yourself was really hands-on. I mean, that is very surprising for a developer who's so hands-on. You were really hands-on. I remember during the time we were talking about it.
Well, I think I'm quite involved in all of my projects because they're sort of, for me, they're passion projects. You know, I've developed, you know, hundreds of projects over the last 35 years. And then certainly in the last, you know, 15 years of my life, my projects have become really passionate projects. Mm. So they're with architects that I want to work with. They're more landmark projects. If you look at 1111 Lincoln Road, you know, for many, many years, people tried to bring a world-class architect to Miami Beach to build a building. And because of the zoning requirements, you know, most buildings got shut down. So we were really one of the first buildings that was a world-class architectural building. And it really created the Renaissance. I think people look at that building as really creating the surge of what you see in Miami. I think you were commenting to me today, like, how many buildings have just been built in Miami in the last 10 years? Well, most of them now have world-class architects. That wasn't the case. I think our building in 2008, when we started construction, was really the first building done by a world-class architect. And it set the standard for what people needed to do. So there's a formula. It's not just a glamour project where you just spend a lot more money and you don't get anything in return. Not only do you get a project that is far better than one you would do with a normal architecture, but you also are able to achieve higher returns because people are more interested in being in the project.
So your other half is doing something completely different from you. So Mario, you are doing a lot in media about social media content. What brings you to do that? Because if you are starting as a diplomat and then you start to do media, you study media, and then you brought in a lot of social media, you're interested in and in that. Tell me more about it.
I think it comes from my upbringing. The way that my family raised us with the values, the schooling that I had growing up from K to 12. I call it, it's the extension of the social gospel, which is the
social gospel,
which is the do good to others theory. So that was my upbringing. So it's inside of me to do that, right? Or to want to do that. So I studied communications and marketing. Then I studied international affairs and had the diplomatic stint. And I realized it was great, but not really what I wanted to do. So serendipitously here in Miami, I met the then president of MTV. Mm-hmm. And she had this idea of using the power of the brand of MTV to shape youth's mind with a positive impact. And her boss, who was the president of MTV International, had started a campaign to create awareness and prevention on HIV/AIDS. And yes, it was taking off, and it's called MTV Staying Alive. So the president here in the Americas, she said, I want to do something similar and something that it's also a social issue with our US audience, with our Latin American audience, because that was the audience that we were reaching.
Yeah.
So we added human trafficking. We added teen pregnancy, which was a big issue.
Big
it still thing. Is, but it was a much bigger issue than voting, especially in the countries like the U.S. and other countries in Latin America where you have to register to vote, and it's not mandatory like some other countries. And so we had all these large issues, and we even took on some very small issues like the blue whales in Chile. So we did big campaigns, global campaigns, Americas campaigns, and then more localized campaigns. I stopped being a full-time employee in 2017, and ever since then I still work producing MTV documentaries, about one documentary a year, more or less, so maybe every 2 years. So I started to question where all these issues coming from. And it dawned on me that it's related to religion, but not the but not the devotional religion that I grew up with.
Because South American is very
it's
religious.
It's a very religious, very religious, but not, right? So I wanted to understand how can you study about religion other than the devotional aspect. And one thing led me into another until I found the Harvard Divinity School, who offers both. If you want to study religion.
By the way, audience, Mario just graduated from his master's degree in theology at Harvard, and I was at his party celebrating that. In May.
In May, yes.
Yeah.
So I started to take one course at a time because I was working full-time, and eventually I left my job to go more full-time until I was completely full-time studying it. The idea was to study, so Harvard Divinity School offers basically two tracks. One is to study religion from the devotional aspect. If you want to be a rabbi, you want to be a priest, mm-hmm. you want to be ordained and a practitioner of religion. And then the other track is more of understanding religion from the theology side or how religion intersects with public life. And that's the focus that I picked because I wanted to understand how religion intersects with media. And within media, you have journalism media, and then you have media and entertainment. Since I come from media and entertainment, that was my focus of studies. And what I'm trying to uncover is what is the social impact that all of these TV shows that we produce in the US, in Hollywood, that travel around the world often or almost always, and not the other way around. It's very seldom that a TV show from outside of the U.S. comes to the U.S. or travels around the world. It happens, but not in percentages. It's more out of Hollywood, right? So I am wondering, what is the global impact these TV shows are doing when the social norms that are being used to write this script writing is the American norms? And are we, in a way, capturing the world's attention through film? And what is that impact?
And do you write a dissertation on that?
Yes. So my thesis, it's called Bringing Religious Literacy to Hollywood. And it's a blueprint in how to do it with some case studies of how I did it. But it's an ongoing work.
Wow. Robert, as his partner, what is your comment? And your partner is completely the opposite of you. I mean, how do you think about your partner going to study religion?
Oh, I mean, I think that the reason the relationship has worked for 34 years is we're the yin and the yang, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, Mario spent his career in corporate social responsibility, and, you know, my career was on... was more on an economic impact. So, but I think like what's fascinating about what Mario is doing is, you know, he realized that that there was so much religious content in films and movie, and he approached Viacom and said, you know, I want to do a religious literacy campaign. And they said, oh, no, we don't touch religion. And what was interesting is that, you know, religious literacy for Mario from a corporate social responsibility standpoint was no different than LGBTQIA issues or teen pregnancy or all the other issues. Mario wasn't interested in teaching religion. He was just trying
to understand
that people
pluralism.
Are producing films and movies have put so much religious content in it, and for people to realize what we're absorbing. You need, in order to be able to understand, you know, the people around us, you need to understand their religious background. So I think it's really fascinating because it's, you know, everybody says, oh, Mario went off to Harvard to study religion. Well, I think in reality, he went off to Harvard to expand his knowledge in media and communication on religious literacy. So I was all in favor. In fact, I moved for the entire last year to Boston while Mario was there.
He's supporting Mario to finish his degree.
Yes.
It's very admirable.
So obviously I was, you know, quite in favor of what he was doing and very proud of what he's been able to accomplish.
I mean, we are all very proud because who would look into that? That, you know, that's very narrow.
It is very narrow.
Perspective of things, you know, it's just really.
And when I started, which was 12 years ago, thinking about it, and I started to study 9 years ago, that's when I started studying it, people didn't quite understand why I was doing it. They thought I wanted to become religious, like a practitioner. They thought I was trying to push a religion. And I was merely doing what Robert described, and I would probably add to religious literacy, media literacy, for people to understand how to consume media and the impact that any comedy, any drama, any thriller can have how you will behave next when you go to the streets, right?
Between the both of you, right? I mean, the foundation that you done. Robert, you're involved as well, right? The foundation. So does this this art foundation that you created actually is impacted to how you think about religion?
In a way, it is, because it's the way that I now think of religion is more from the anthropological, sociological lens, much more than the devotional aspect, and how religion has impacted race and the different scales of race and class and the different scales of class and gender,
yes,
the scale of gender. So understanding religion as the one thing that weaves into all these issues or social issues, yeah, it is. So there is a disadvantage for artists who are working out of countries like El Salvador, and now I'm focused on all of Central America. And the idea of our arts foundation is to bring opportunities to this artist.
And giving global platform, and that's what you were saying.
And now I'm going to throw the potato back at you, because you may recall that, I don't know, 15 years ago, we came to visit you. And
yes, that's how we connected in Shanghai.
And we follow you in Beijing, in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, in Singapore. I can't remember where else we went, Vietnam, Thailand. I wanted to understand.
You missed out on Brazil. Robin we were in Brazil.
And I wanted to understand how you did what you did, how you started this amazing Chinese contemporary art movement, and how you brought it to the world. And you said to me, well, it's hard to explain. Come and shadow me for a little bit, and the conversation will flourish. And so you're one of the mentors that we had in launching our arts project.
But your art project is very impressive. I always consider myself as lucky. I'm just at the right time, because China, at that time, everybody is looking at China.
Right.
When you're looking at China, you look at the Chinese culture and art. And I'm just happening at the right time and the right place. That's all I can say. And then I'm there witnessing the evolution of the Chinese contemporary art, just there. And then I think you guys have done a lot for the South American art. You know, you create a foundation, you give opportunities. And then I think Robert using the building as you know, his vision. And now with this new projects you are doing, with Mario's idea of building, giving opportunities for this, for the South Americans. Are you using this to think about your big real estate project, which will be 10 years to finish, 10 years?
I mean, it's interesting. I think that Mario and I are working not only on the future of the real estate project here in Alapata, where we plan on building a community in and around our value system and our social morals. But I think also in our foundation, so you were talking about the arts, but, you know, we do many other things inside the foundation. Mm. So we have a very large program for LGBTQIA youth. And we've supported a lot of AIDS and HIV research.
I know, you make a donation on the
So yeah, we have a program with HIV, Rockefeller Center right now, where we're working on the first broadly neutralizing antibody, which would be a functional cure for HIV, and we're in final human trials. But inside the foundation also now, as Mario and my ideas merge together, we're actually right now working on a campaign to combat the rise of Christian nationalism. So that brings Mario's religious ideas, as well as my concerns for LGBTQI youth, because with the rise of Christian nationalism, you have a huge effect on LGBTQI youth.
Absolutely.
Who are being persecuted by their own families.
Yeah.
And people around them, by the church, by all the people that they are.
But I thought now the Pope is really embracing all the, you know.
Well, I think that you know, the Pope embracing, say, gay marriage or LGBTQ is different than it's different than the right wing nationalism going on in the United States. And what you see, we live in Florida, which is, you know, one of the most right wing states besides Texas. And if you look at all the bans, both on books and trans issues and LGBTQIA issues, there are a lot of mental, suicidal, teenage issues, homelessness, things that we're really are trying to respond to in our foundation right now and try to help youth understand, you know, that they can be both LGBTQIA and live in a state where you have a huge, I mean, there's so many, I just read an article recently how trans families are all moving out of the state of Florida because they can no longer get gender affirming care and other things. So, you know, it has a huge impact on not only our youth, which is something that we're very much trying to help, but in terms of families in general, you know, that are so affected in Florida for just parents being able to do what they think is right for their children. So I think, you know, in the foundation, we've been able to merge a lot of our common interests in finding new places to
amazing.
So Robert's passion since I've met him has been supporting LGBTQAI youth rights and services, right? So you merge that with my passion on religious literacy and my media background, and now we're coming up with this campaign to educate while keeping the lessons learned at HDS,
What is HDS?
Harvard Divinity School.
Okay.
Sorry. So while keeping the takeaways of having studied at Harvard Divinity School, which is think what you're going to do will not create more division or it will not create more hate. So with those two guiding questions, we're trying to figure out a way to mitigate this pushback that LGBTQ people are getting from a religious group. A very large, a very powerful religious group that is pushing back on LGBTQ rights and services.
So your foundation is not just touching on South Americans, but is actually addressing and helping responding to the general issues.
Yes. So basically, we have a two-prong approach. One is the arts, visual arts, and very specifically Central American contemporary arts support. And from there, it's my being involved with MoMA in New York with the Reina Sofia in Madrid, because it's the way to make it global. And then the other prong would be the LGBTQ rights and services, which also includes the finding the cure of HIV/AIDS.
Tell me your involvement with these institutions. Tell me more about
on the arts side.
On the arts side.
Other than you, that has been an amazing mentor in this particular track of our life, we have other people who made a significant impact in our lives, such as Amy Capellazzo. The advice that we received was one of us has to be present in these institutions to bring the voice. Because if you are not present, that voice is never going to really be heard.
You cannot push
through. So I came with a very clear agenda of what my role was going to be as I joined the boards of the MoMA Latin American and Caribbean Fund and the Reina Sofia the Reina Sofia Art Museum in Madrid.
Yeah.
And while doing that, I was also learning how Patty Cisneros created the Cisneros Institute for Latin American Art at MoMA, because I had my vision of doing something like that for Central America. Luckily, the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid responded favorable to the idea of creating an institute for Central American contemporary arts. And we're working on that right now. Hopefully it will launch next year, and it will be a research institute that also advocates for the Central American artist inclusion in, let's say, everything that the museum Reina Sofia is doing or is planning to do. Also will advocate for more research papers to be published. It will advocate for, well, publishing paper books as well.
No, but that's important because...
And growing the collection, yeah.
It's important because, I mean, archiving, you know, there's so many academics, they want to do research. And without these, you can't go further. Robert, tell us more about this new project. 9 acres land around here. So
we start assembling land. So it's fortuitous that we're sitting here at the Rubel Collection because both the Rubels and myself in 2016 recognized that this was an emerging area that we wanted to be involved with. The Rubels, of course, had been involved in Wynwood. I had been involved in Miami Beach. And this area, which we call Alapata, is just west of Wynwood and just north of the hospital district. And the hospital district is the number one employer in the entire state of Florida. So there's a huge demand for services and things because of the amount of people that are here in this neighborhood. So this was a warehouse neighborhood, mostly wholesale produce and fruit. And so at the same time, which we didn't know, we both recognized that this was an area that we thought was an interesting area to buy in. And so I assembled about 9 acres of land here. They also assembled the properties where their museum is, where we're sitting, and properties around them. And we've been investing in the area since 2016. And we have hired Bjark Ingels from the Big Group to work on a master plan to build residential and retail office and potentially hotel here in Alapata, which will be about a 10-year project. We have the ability to build, at this point, with the new zoning in the state of Florida, up to 4,000 new residential units. And we're the largest site right now in the city of Miami. So it's a very valuable site. We currently operate the wholesale produce market. So I'm in the wholesale produce business right now, a new business for me.
Selling fruits and vegetables
since 2016.
Just like Carmen Miranda.
So,
it's very good for you during COVID time.
Yeah, we were very busy during COVID. So we have a very active market, and the population is, of course, where we have Brickell on one side, we have Wynwood on the other side, we have downtown Miami, we have the design district just to the north. So it's really, and we're on Metro. So one of the most important things about this area, which I think the Rubels were also one of the reasons they were interested in coming here as well, is we're right on the Metro. So the Metro stop is actually on our
property. Are you having Metro here?
Metro, yes.
The Miami Metro.
And the ridership has increased dramatically, both because the Metro is now connected to the Bright Line, which is the high-speed train that goes all the way to Orlando, stops in West Palm Beach,
Fort Lauderdale, and down to the city.
So, mass transportation is going to be, as you've seen, the amount of new buildings, 100-story buildings being built all over Brickell. We don't have enough room for cars. So our project will be a transit-oriented residential and retail development project that will probably be built in 4 phases over the next 10 years.
Wow. This is like taking a risk, right? 2016, when you didn't even know any, you have no...
Well, I think, if you look at my careers over the last 35 years, everything I've done has been in emerging markets. In 1998, 99, I was one of the first developers to buy property in the meatpacking district. Nobody was in the meatpacking district but meat cutters. So, I've always, when I started my career in the late 1970s, I was selling townhouses in the South End for $20,000 or $30,000.
In Boston, which
are now, say, $5 million houses, and nobody wanted them. So my whole career has been about finding... Because I moved to New York in 1978. My friends were all artists and fashion people, and I was really into the underground culture, club scene. And so for me, emerging markets and finding new areas was always been of my interest. So almost all my projects. So Alopatra was not very much different. I saw it as an opportunity. I saw it as a market that, you know, over time, would improve in Miami. But, you know, as most people know, in emerging markets, you know, you follow art, culture, LGBTQIA, all of that is usually a sign of an emerging neighborhood. So it's been very successful here, and we look forward to, you know, making a vibrant community here over the next 10 years without destroying the fabric. So we plan on, you know, utilizing the warehouse concept in our retail spaces so the ground floors feel like warehouse spaces so that we just don't wipe the whole fabric away from the area. Mm.
Wow. I mean, the same thing. You always have a vision, and your vision always is very exact. You really have a good feel about it, of what you do, of your and of the location.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I fall counterculture. That's kind of, if people ask me, like, what is it about me? And I say, well, I've always followed counterculture, and it's served me very, very well, because, you know, counterculture is usually first into neighborhoods. So I've never really felt, it's interesting because everybody said, like, even with 11/11, how much risk? You know, it's interesting for me. I'm always able to measure my downside risk. So like here in Alopatra, my downside risk was I was going to be one of the most famous operators of a wholesale produce market. So that was my downside risk. My upside risk was the vision that we have for the neighborhood. But, you know, I always take calculated risks. I always believe that the neighborhoods that we're going into are neighborhoods that are very... Yeah, but they're also neighborhoods that are very close to urban population centers. You know, they are out of favor at the time, but they're close enough to realize when a city expands. And we've done the same thing in Washington, D.C. We've done the same thing in California. We've done the same thing in Boston. We've chosen neighborhoods where we have a vision that just being patient over time, the neighborhood will come to you. And long-term that's really planning. Been our strategy.
Is this why you're attracted to Robert, his dynamism, Mario?
Absolutely, yes. It keeps me on my toes.
I love to talk about you too.
Well, Mario and I used to drive around for the first 15 years of our relationship, and my idea of our entertainment and date was to drive him around to show him properties that I was interested in buying. So
hours and days.
And days and hours.
And at that time, we had a little convertible, and we would put the top down, and we would drive for hours. And of course, there was no cell phones.
So we had to talk.
And there was no GPS. So basically, you had maps.
I was the co-pilot.
So yeah, you had to open up your maps and look at a map, and you really had to have... You know, you really had to have a good sense of intuition, because, you know, you really had to follow signs. Like today, you know, everybody, like, you get into a car, you put it into your GPS, it takes you where you're going, you can fall asleep, nobody really cares. But
it was like
days,
one of those
really
car racing road rallies.
My God.
You know, you really had to know what you were doing, because if you missed a road, you know, you could be 30 minutes off the highway.
Which we did a couple of times.
You did a couple of times.
Because the signage was not...
Well, and there was no technology. Clear. I mean, we are, you know, we forget, you know, that wasn't so long ago, 25 years ago, that there really was not much technology. Yeah. So you needed to have
I
the
mean,
old-fashioned way, like
that.
A map.
You would just drive around, and Mario, you're co-piloting,
We had a book with a spiral binder with all the zoom-ins of the cities, because the big map was sometimes... not detailed enough, so you had to like go from the big map to the book while he's driving, and you're
this
looking
is,
at the signs.
This is your
it was a
full-time
job.
Time being together.
Yes, those were our dates.
It served us well, but I mean, I think, you know, in order to really understand a city, you need to be able to drive it.
Yeah,
and I think actually maps are I still use maps. I love maps because I think when you have to focus on a map, you really, really understand a city much better than when you just plug something in and tell you to take it there, because, you know, you don't see what's around you. And it's really important to see what's around you, because if you look at this neighborhood, you know, as I said, we have like these booming neighborhoods all around us. So it's quite intuitive to think that you're the whole, kind of the hole in the donut, and which is exactly what we thought about, let's say, in Meatpacking District. You had the West Village, you had Chelsea, yes. You had all these incredible neighborhoods around you, and then you had this just little hole in the donut, which was called the Meatpacking Districts. And of course, nobody wanted to go there because, you know, it was all about cutting meat. But eventually you knew that that donut hole would get filled. So I think, you know, that's just been our strategy.
For me, this is amazing to hear how you all date driving around and how you try and find location. But do you ever make a mistake?
You know,
I mean, now experience will tell you. But when you first started, I mean, you must have made mistakes.
Well, we all make mistakes, yeah. Obviously. But I think, you know,
but can you remember?
Fortunately for me, a mistake has only turned out to be as not a bigger success as some other projects. So if you look at 1111 Lincoln Road, the multiple on invested capital was so huge. It was such a, you know, such a home run. And other projects are singles and doubles. And, you know, if you do your homework, which we always did, and as I said, I always understood the downside risk, and I never over-leveraged myself, so I never put too much debt. You know, that's one of the problems you see right now is in, you know, big companies, really established companies are giving back properties left and right because they over-leverage their property. So we never over-leveraged. We always understood that what our base case scenario was. What was our downside? What was the worst thing that could happen? I've learned from those projects, but fortunately, we've never had a project that's failed.
If any young person coming in and they said, Robert, I want to follow your example, what would you advise them? Advise them to do?
I think it's changed, because for me, you know, it was always about following artists and LGBTQIA. And I think today it's maybe more about social media and other aspects, but somehow you have to get connected with the culture. If you want to see something before everybody else sees it, you have to be able to figure out a way to get connected early on. And I think that's, you know, whether it can be TikTok or social media or Instagram, you see an idea. And I always said that, like, you know, like, how did I ever find a project? And usually it was that somebody would drop an idea in front of me, or I would be in a city and learn from, as I said, from counterculture. Mm. Like, oh, like, you know, the artists are moving here, or LGBTQI are buying these apartments. So I would say, okay, let me go take a look, okay? And that doesn't mean that always that's a place to buy. But lots of times, it's a really good lead. So I think young people today need to, look, everything is overpriced. The stock market's overpriced, real estate's overpriced. It's not so easy to find things that are undervalued. But I think you really need to be able to find something that other people are not seeing. And therefore, you need to be able to access people that other people are not accessing. And that, to me, is really always in the underground. Yeah. When it's just starting, just like you and artists, or the Rubels, how they come up with undiscovered artists. And so if you really want to do something that's grassroots, you need to be able to connect with counterculture.
Bravo. And so, Mario, for you, if a young person coming in and asking for your advice, like, what am I going to do? Am I going to do things not being paid, or pay and earn very little money, but I want to do social good. Social good. What are you going to advise?
So, to answer your question, what would I advise a young person that wants to get into the media social impact industry? First and foremost, you have to dig deep inside and understand why you want to do it and what are your passions, so that you can then identify an issue that speaks to that passion that you have, and understand that issue, study it, learn it, get involved with
and
it.
Research about it.
Then, very importantly, get experience in media production. It doesn't matter what you're doing, as long as you're in front of the media production industry, so that you can eventually merge your passion, the issue, with the media production. And for today's media consumer, the most important is to stay true, because the audience can easily detect when it's not authentic.
Okay. But recently we learned that there are leaders of a society of country, but they use not very authentic words to market themselves. I mean, but people buy all these untruthful words.
Sure.
So I thought the world is changing. I mean, this is encouraging people not to be truthful.
Right. So that's where the media literacy component comes very handy. If you teach and if you learn how to consume media, it's very important, because then you'll be able to discern from what's authentic, what's fake, or what is a misinformation or disinformation. But if a young person wants to get into, which was the
question,
whatever that they try to produce has to be original and has to be authentic, especially if it's a brand that is trying to get behind a cause, which is called cause marketing, right? People can smell it when the brand is doing something of social impact, very superficial, just to look good. They can. The audience, I think, is smart enough to know it's not authentic. Now, going back to your second question, why is it that that same audience is smart enough to detect a not authentic media marketing campaign, social impact marketing campaign? Why is it that they do buy into cults or political figures?
Why?
I don't know.
Because I think today people like to believe what they want to believe. They don't even want to check anything.
Well,
there are words that resonate them, then they choose to believe.
Right. So often that's called the echo chamber, which means that you like to hear what you know over and over as an echo effect, like hello, mm-hmm. or echo effect. I mean, I fall into that. When I read something that I like and that agrees with the way I feel, my social norms and my values, I even share it. And then I catch myself thinking, did I even check the source, the intention, like all those little check marks that you're supposed to be checking? It's because the power of media has now gone from a trained journalist, let's say, to the people. And you have people giving their opinions. And a lot of them present their opinions pretty convincing. And we're living in such a fast-paced media scrolling, yes, no, that you just stop where you think sounds good and you check.
I agree. Yeah.
I'd like to add just one other thing. I think I like the old-fashioned networking and keep your ear to the ground. I think people just get lost in their phones and their social media. And if you want to be successful, I think that old-fashioned networking and listening to your ear to the ground, being out there and listening for cues.
I agree.
More people, for young people, just forget how important that is.
I agree, because a lot of young people just look at the screen. They don't have this physical contact with people. I think
the truly hanging out, building relationships.
The Gen Z social relation, and how they build their social network is really different from ours. So I really want to learn from them how they can be.
Some of them are immensely successful and even more successful than people in our generation.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that they will not be successful, but no. I think that Robert's advice is pretty solid that, hey, it's better anyway. you get to feel what's going on in the ground.
But a lot of, I mean, I think a lot of Gen Z doesn't even have the social skills because from morning to night, they just stick on the screen. A lot of them is like that. Anyway, on this note, to thank you, my two very good friends, for joining the podcast. And anyway, we have dinner tonight.
Yes.
Yes.
Perfect. Can't wait for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.